Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you, and it's a delight and pleasure to be here today. If I could just have my first slide up, please. So I've been asked to speak to you on the epidemiology of homelessness and exclusion, and I suppose I could give you some numerical facts, which we sometimes associate with the idea of epidemiologic study. I could cite some very facts that are perhaps already well known to you. These are from Crisis, looking at the prevalence of homelessness in England, where there are about 2,400 rough sleepers each night, which is a 37% increase over the last 3 years, where there are 113,000 households applying for homelessness assistance in a single year, which is an 11% increase over 2 years. I could also speak to you about the statistics on homelessness in the country where I work and live, Canada, where more than 30,000 people are homeless each night, where 150,000 different people stay at a homeless shelter each year, and where an estimated 2% of all Canadians have been homeless in the last 5 years. However, what I'd like to talk to you today about is not so much the statistics and the numbers of homelessness, but reflect a bit on my personal journey and thoughts about what is the solution to the problem of homelessness that we all encounter in our lives and in our work. Is it healthcare that we need? Is it housing and supports? Or is it an attack on the social and economic exclusion that underlies the problem? So to explain my thinking on this, I'm going to tell you a bit of my personal journey, which starts in Boston about 20 years ago, where after completing my training in general internal medicine, I went to work as a young physician with the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program. This is one of the Pine Street Inn. This is one of the largest shelters in Boston. And I worked in a shelter very similar to this. And this is a photograph from the clinic at that shelter with nurses and physicians providing care to the men at that shelter. Now, what I realized as a physician working with these patients was that, one, they had a host of health problems that were severe and uncontrolled, and that they were dying at an extraordinarily high rate and at very young ages. And so what I set about doing was what I thought was the right thing to do and what I was trained to do, and that was to provide the best possible health care I could for these individuals. Now, my impression that these patients were dying at a very young age was not just an impression. It was actually borne out by subsequent research. And this is a slide showing data not from Boston, but from across Canada, which shows the probability that a man or a woman will survive to the age of 75. Now, I'll just, I know you can't read it very well, but what I'll do is I'll just explain it to you. What is showing on the left for men and on the right for women is what's the probability of surviving to age 75. And what you can see is that there's this gradient. The white bar at the far right is for the richest fifth of Canadians. The light blue bar is for the general population, and the darker blue bar is for the poorest fifth of the population. But what you can see on the far left of each set of bars is a dark blue bar, and that is the likelihood that a man or a woman living in a shelter, a rooming house, or a single-room occupancy hotel, those who are vulnerably housed and homeless, will survive to age 75. And for a man living in Canada today, that probability is only 30%. To put that in perspective, that's the likelihood of a man surviving to the age of 75 in 1929, before we had antibiotics, before we had any of the effective health therapies that we have today. So being a homeless man or a woman in Canada today is like living back in the Great Depression. So armed with this observation, I set about in my work in Boston thinking that the solution to the problem was to provide more and better health care. And I think, just reflecting on the experience that I had there, is that for those of us who are clinicians or frontline workers who care for people who are homeless, it's both an incredibly powerful, motivating experience, but it's also potentially hazardous. Because we have such an immediate connection to the men and women experiencing homelessness, we focus on doing what we do best, which is giving them the best possible health care or providing the best possible services that we can provide. But what we may neglect in that connection is the fact that we are working in a broader systems and social environment that may, in fact, be counteracting our best efforts. And in fact, what I discovered as a clinician was that I was helping people control their blood pressure, address their heart disease, their alcoholism, and yet many of them were still homeless, and many of them were still dying. And this graph, again, which I'll just explain to you, it doesn't really project very well, explains the underlying challenge that we face. This just shows changes in mortality rates in people who are homeless in Boston over the last 15 years. And so I'll just explain it to you because I know it's hard to read. Essentially, this graph shows deaths due to natural causes, things like heart disease, liver disease, chronic respiratory disease, flu, and HIV. And if things are to the left, it means that actually the rate of death due to those causes dropped over 15 years. And this is during a period in which healthcare was being provided more aggressively and in a better, more coordinated way to people who are homeless in Boston. And actually what you can see is that this effort, to some extent, was successful. The rates of death due to cancer dropped. The rates due to HIV actually dropped dramatically, in part due to the revolution in antiretroviral therapy. So overall, deaths due to natural causes among people who are homeless dropped. But at the same time, what happened was that deaths due to external causes skyrocketed. And in fact, deaths due to drug overdoses more than doubled in that same 15-year time period. So while we saw a decrease in deaths due to natural causes, we saw an increase in deaths due to external causes. And the overall net outcome was that the rates of death did not change at all. So I think that the lesson that I took from this experience was that healthcare is indeed vital, and what we do as healthcare providers and social service providers is indeed vital, but it's not enough. And so the second thought that this brought me to was that obviously what we need to be providing is not just healthcare. We need to be coordinating and providing housing and supports for those most in need. And I just want to spend a few minutes telling you about an ongoing study that we're doing now in Canada called the At Home or Chez Soi study, which is a randomized controlled trial of housing first interventions for people who are homeless and have serious mental illness, sponsored by the Mental Health Commission of Canada. So the housing first model that this study is examining is an intervention which says, rather than treating the issue of homelessness and mental illness among individuals living on the street or in shelters as one to be overcome in a stair-step fashion in which someone who's homeless is told, first of all, you need to get off the street and into the shelter, and if you do okay there, then we'll put you in transitional housing, and then if you do okay in transitional housing, we'll get you into permanent housing. And along the way, you need to get into psychiatric treatment because you have mental illness. You need to be compliant with your treatment. If you use drugs or alcohol, you need to be abstinent from drugs or alcohol, and eventually you'll make it up to getting housing. What the Housing First model says is no, housing is a human right and a necessity for being healthy and for achieving recovery from illness. So what we're going to do is we're going to say you're homeless today, but we can move you directly into permanent housing, and we're not going to require you to undertake treatment or to be abstinent from substance use. And this model is accomplished by a combination of housing, which in our program is provided with scattered site apartments in private market apartment buildings with the use of rent supplements in conjunction with supports in the form of either assertive community treatment for those with high needs or intensive case management for those with moderate needs. So this is a combined housing and support intervention. Now, the story of this study and this intervention is actually told incredibly well at this site, athome.nfb.ca, which actually provides videos and stories and gives you really a glimpse into what it meant to be a participant in the study or a researcher in the study or a housing and service provider in the study. And I just recommend it highly. It's an incredible site. When you go to it, each one of these little dots you can click on is a video that tells a story. What we found is, in fact, our intervention, the Housing First intervention, is successful in ending homelessness for people who've been chronically homeless. And in the first year after the intervention, people in the intervention group spent 69% of their time housed, whereas those in the usual care group only spent 25% of their time housed. And we saw improvements in other outcomes, such as community functioning. These graphs just show in the dotted line the intervention group, in the solid line the control group, and you can see that there were significant improvements in community functioning in the intervention participants and in the quality of life of participants who received the intervention. Now, I wish that I could end my story there and say that the answer is healthcare and housing and supports. But I think there's a little bit more to the story that I just need to explain. This graph shows the health status of people that were in our program. And you can see that both lines are overlapping. Essentially, over the first 1 year of the study, the health status of people receiving the housing and support intervention, the vast majority of which, by the end of the study, 85% were housed, did not improve, did not change any, was not any different than that of people in the control group who received nothing in the course of the study. So you might ask, what is going on here? And we've asked ourselves that question. But I think for those of us who have lived experience or who have worked with people in this who have struggled with homelessness and poverty, realize that the health impacts of homelessness and exclusion are not overcome with 1 year of housing. That we are working against a lifetime of adversity and adverse health effects, and that these are not overcome simply with a program, no matter how successful it is in ending people's homelessness. And I'm just showing this graph again because it really illustrates the fact that what I didn't comment on earlier is that, as you can see, there's a very strong socioeconomic gradient. There's a very strong socioeconomic gradient here, which is that the more wealthy you are, the longer your life expectancy, the poorer you are, the shorter your life expectancy, and homelessness is simply the extreme of that degree of deprivation. It's simply the sixth quintile. It's below being in the lowest fifth of the population. It is an extreme level of deprivation and exclusion, and of course it has extreme effects on people's health, but it's simply the tip of the iceberg. It's really just an example of what happens at the extreme. And this is a process that's happening across our society, not just to people who are homeless. And so the reason this picture is here is that this is a picture of the Yangtze River in China. And one day, the residents of this major city in Chongqing woke up and discovered that the river had turned blood red. Now, this is not a normal occurrence for this river. And the answer to this problem might at first glance to be, well, we'd better clean the water. We'd better do something to our situation at hand here. But a moment's thought about this makes it absolutely clear that the problem lies upstream, The problem does not lie in this city. The problem lies in the upstream factories and upstream forces that are creating this toxic red tide of water coming down the river. And so when we think about the solutions to the problems that we encounter in terms of homelessness, yes, the answer is more and better access to health care and access to better high-quality health care. Yes, the answer is housing and supports, because we can end homelessness for people who are chronically homeless. But we also have to attack the social and economic roots of this problem, because although the title of my talk is The Epidemiology of Homelessness and Exclusion, as the previous speaker has already pointed out, it should really be about the social production of homelessness and exclusion, because this is not an illness that is happening because of some environmental exposure or genetic factor in our population beyond our control. This is a phenomenon that's happening because we are making choices as a society that are producing this problem. And this is just a picture just to remind us of this. This is a photograph from a neighborhood in Toronto called Regent Park. It's what we call social housing or in Canada, or public housing. And as you can see, it's a bleak landscape. It's a neighborhood and an environment in which children growing up are set up for failure and exclusion in our society. Now, we can't ignore that this is one of the fundamental underpinnings of what's happening when we see people in shelters and on the street. And we have to make a commitment, and this is a real picture of a real transformation. We have to make a commitment as a society to reimagine our world in a way where there are people of high and low income living together, where there's economic opportunity and education available for all. And believe it or not, these photographs are, this is not a fake montage. This is actually a real photograph taken of this same neighborhood 10 years later. So this change is possible. We just have to find the will to do it. And I think that as clinicians, service providers, frontline workers, and people with lived experience, we understand that this is not just some abstraction. These are not just numbers or figures. These are photographs, portraits taken by Rosie Holtom of homeless people in London. And these are the faces and the faces and the lives of people that we know as individuals, that we know as people with dignity and with a right to live a life that is healthy and wholesome, and we owe it to them. So let's remember, as we look at these photographs, that we are called to both deliver health care and work to provide health, housing and supports, and also attack the underpinnings of the problems that we face. Thank you very much.